evening. Welcome to a special edition of The Blues. I'm Lee Hay. Big Joe Duskin was a legend in the Cincinnati blues community and known throughout the world for his boogie-woogie piano style. After his passing in the spring of 2007, several musicians came into the studio to talk about their friend. You'll hear at the beginning of the show from Philip Paul, studio drummer at King Records, followed by a roundtable discussion of Big Joe by Ricky Nye, Sweet Alice Hoskins, and Renaud Petenier. Big Joe Duskin remembered on the blues.
The taste is great with the boogie beat. Take the lid off the pot and turn on the heat. Everybody's up swinging on their feet. Not to mess with the boogie. Don't mess with the boogie. Don't you mess with the boogie. Mess with the boogie, man. I know a secret of the boogie sound. When I run up the keyboard, the tremor don't down. I love to push the grand piano. 6'2" and weigh 300 pounds. Don't you mess with the boogie. Don't you mess with the boogie. Don't you mess with the boogie. Don't mess with the boogie, man. The joints get jumping, the women understand. Men cry mercy and throw up their hand. Look out, everybody, here's the boogeyman. Don't you mess with the boogie. Don't mess with the boogie. Don't you mess with the boogie. Don't mess with the boogeyman.
In the 70s, Tiny Bradshaw had passed away, so I already established a home here in Cincinnati, so rather than go back to New York, I decided to stay here. I was married and had responsibilities, so I stayed in Cincinnati, so I started working locally, and I was playing at a little club in Coryville called the Avalon. It was a club that we played on Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, like a jam session type thing, and Joe Duskin would come in all the time, you know. It was ideal for all people because we would start playing at maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon, play till 6, and he would come in and he always tried to get me to play with him. So I said, no, I don't think I want to do that. He was talking about going to Europe and traveling all over, so we remained friends up until 2000, I think, a little before 2000, and he approached me again, and through Larry Nager, I decided that yes, Riley would do a session with him. So in preparation for that, I did a couple jobs around town with him, you know, so we could get acquainted with one another. And very nice man, you know. We got along famously. In fact, not only did we play together, we talked together on the phone. He would call me, and I would call him, and I was always concerned about how he felt, and very big heart, you know. So I think Larry Nager talked to me about doing a session, and we did it over at a church in Clifton. very odd, you know, but very relaxed. A bass player friend of mine, Ed Connolly, who is also an alumni of King Records, he and I were on it, and a couple other people. But Joe just played, and we caught on to what he was doing, and when it felt comfortable, we recorded it. And we did some very interesting things, you know. And he was quite different. On stage, he always told stories about his childhood and his family preceding the song that he did. It was like a storybook performance, you know. And very interesting. And he played differently, you know. I loved him. Nice man. Very nice man. I never did go out on the road with him. I never got a chance to do that, you know, but I know a lot of local musicians that did. Some of the stories weren't so pleasant because you go out on you go out on the road and things happen. You know, not things seem to happen to musicians as far as getting paid and promoters running out on you and just horrible. You know, I've had a lifetime of those experiences, and I really wasn't interested in doing that again. You know, even with Big Joe, but. I'm glad it didn't come down to anything unpleasant because all the things that I can remember about Big Joe were very pleasant, and he paid me what I wanted, and we did the music and had a good time. Wonderful man.
Every day. Every day I have the blues. Every day. Every day I have the blues. When you see me worried, crying, darling, you, I'm about to lose. Nobody loved me. Baby, don't you know nobody cared? Nobody loved me. Baby, don't you know nobody cared? You know I'm gonna pack my suitcase, darling. Move away from here. It's a low down dirty shame. You know I found my little baby in the arms of one of my best friends. My suitcase is packed. Baby, my trunk is already gone. Baby, my truck's already gone. If you don't believe I'm leaving you, darling, hold your breath and count the days and you'll be gone.
every day I have the blues. Every day I have the blues. When you see me whining, crying, darling, you, I'm about to lose. Nobody, nothing, baby, don't you know nobody care. You're gonna pack my suitcase, darling. Move away from here.
That's the only song that's so long.
I'm Sweet Alice Hoskins, and I made acquaintance with Joe Duskin many, many years ago. I went to school with his children. Big Joe Duskin, when he was doing singing, I started following the blues. When I went to a gig and heard Joe playing the boogie woogie, that was just, I was just amazed. So I started asked him how he, you know, how he was doing or what he was doing. I didn't know anything about the piano, and he just says, you just have to watch your left hand, you have to let the left hand do it, you know, do his thing. So I got to know him from that, and years later we end up, when I did get into business, I end up running into him several times, many times, and then we went cross seas. And he had been already going to Paris, Mr. Vaucher's. And Mr. Vaucher called me and had asked me to come over. And he was using his Cincinnati Blues connection as theme. So Joe and I was on the same bill. And he was a headline, of course. I was opening. So, but well, the shows was great. We had great audience. He had said he didn't work on Friday. So this particular Friday, he was like, I'm not working. So he said, I'm not even going over. So then he came over. And that time, Bobby Jones from the gospel, he was there, and a couple of his entourage, a couple of people, and Clay Evans out of Chicago was there. So they were in the audience with us. So he took an went up, played. He couldn't sit still. He got to play. Then when he got to playing, it was my turn. He said, I'm not getting up from this stage. That's about to throw a brick in and brick it at me. But he just played the rest of the night. So it was nice.
Yeah. This is Ricky Nye here. I saw footage of that evening, or one of those evenings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember it was Al, yourself and Al, and, mm-hmm. and Russell and Joe. And Joe was so revered by all the European pianists.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was really loved. And whenever I would go over to play in, you know, whatever country, and I would see my friends, like my friend here, Renaud, who it wasn't seconds before they would ask, how's Big Joe?
Yeah, that's the first thing they ask when you go by yourself.
Yeah, and you know, and when you were talking about meeting Joe, I met him in, it was probably 82 or 83, before I was even messing around with Boogie Woogie or anything. And, you know, I could play some blues, but mm-hmm. I was playing in a rock and roll band at the time. But I met him at the repair shop. And, you know, he's one of those guys, as soon as you meet him and you're talking to him, you're just friends.
Friends, yeah.
You know? And I just remember every time I would see him when we would part, I would just feel so tickled to death, you know, that he would just be so open with me and so friendly to me. Because he knew I played, but he didn't really know a whole lot about my playing. But I think he knew that I had something going on, you know.
Yeah.
And every time I would get to see him, like when he used to play at Dollar Bill's, he would play those lunchtime sets. And like sometimes I'd play there an evening with a group, like mm-hmm. maybe towards the later 80s. I might have to go in and set up if I had an early gig myself, and I'd get to sit and listen to him, and he'd say, oh, come on, play something.
Yeah, you know? Oh, yeah,
he was good. So I'd play, and he's, oh, I wish I could play like you. I'm like, God, you're crazy. You're crazy. But then when I first started trying to play boogie was really when I first started playing on the Arches boogie piano stage at the Blues Festival. But at that time, I was playing, you know, blues, and I was playing New Orleans type stuff and some kind of rocking sort of piano, but not really boogie woogie, which is a real proper form of music with a certain sort of vocabulary. You can't just sit and go blah, 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 blah and be, that's a boogie. So when I first started to try to learn boogie, it was off of Joe's Cincinnati Stomp record. One great day was when I had learned Cincinnati Stomp. That's okay. The title track of his disc. But when I learned it good enough, I called him on the telephone. I said, Joe, listen to this. So I played it for him. And then he thought it was something else. He thought it was a Pete Johnson boogie or something. I said, no, that's you. I said, that's Cincinnati Stomp, you know. And he's like, oh, guy. You know, he was just like, oh, really? He was one of the people that really made that music attractive to me. And he was always very encouraging. Sometimes musicians let their heads get the best of them. But he was just always such a friend.
Never hear him really say anything bad about anybody. We sit up and he was a big jokester. You never hear him gossip or down at anybody. I've seen people walk up and in the middle of his thing and asking him something about what he was doing, and he would stop and start explaining, explaining what it is and what's going on, you know.
He could do that. I mean, he could take what he did and totally break it down and tell you, this is exactly what I'm doing. Like, he would just slow it down and show you exactly what he's doing. You know, everybody talks about his piano playing and this and that, but, you know, just his singing. If he didn't even play piano, just that big booming voice.
I love that song.
Oh, yeah. And it's just his storytelling, and he had that great storytelling voice. And
Even when he talks, you could hear him very clearly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember the first time I went to the restaurant with my wife and with Joe. Everybody in the restaurant could hear what he was saying. Mm-hmm. He had such a big voice without pushing. It just came out.
One time he was, in relation to what I was saying, just about his voice and he was just a commanding presence, a large, man. And one time he's talking to me and we were playing a show together. And later on we were sitting, he says, Rick, he says, let me give you some advice. He says, don't work so hard.
Oh, yeah. He says,
don't work so hard. He says, take your time. Talk to the people. They like that. And, I said, well, Joe, I says, you're at the time he was like in the 70s, I says, you're an elder statesman. I mean, you've been around, you have this commanding presence and this beautiful, voice. You sound like a classic storyteller, and everything. You play so great. And I says, I'm a little white guy. It's like, I feel like I gotta work. I can't, because if I start trying to do what you do, they'd be like, shut up and play.
He was always sharp, And he matched from head to toe. That's one thing about him. If he had on a blue suit, he had on a blue hat and blue shoes. Uh-huh. He had on a red suit, he had on a red hat, red shoes. He matched always.
Even when he had trouble with his feet and he couldn't necessarily, wear matching shoes or this or that. One year he came to Blues Festival and, his feet and his legs gave him trouble the last several years. He had on like a matching, it was like a baseball outfit.
Okay.
With shorts.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He came to the Arches stage and he's all decked out. And I says, wow. Even when he's not feeling good.
Good.
And he comes to the show, he's all coordinated,
This is a tribute to Pete Johnson, Abbott Emmons, and Meadzuck Lewis. I treasure these guys, Boogie Wiggers, because they was tops. These guys was really knew what they was doing. So here it is. It's Boogie Wiggy. Thank you.
if you look at all the blues artists in the 60s, you know, in particular, you know, Chicago era blues artists of the 50s, 60s, yeah. Man, ties, jackets. You know, caps, you know, hats. I mean, you know, you look at all pictures from that era and
they all
unless you're seeing a rural blues act, like a country blues act, that which you might see, you know, dressed down. Yeah. But if it's any urban blues, you know, any city-fied blues, it's everybody was clean.
Well, I think that too come back from gospel too. See, if you ever see any gospel groups,
oh heck yeah,
they all
super clean.
Super clean. And all of us old school, you are coming out of the gospel field over into, you know, so you carry those traits you picked up, mm-hmm. you know, over into your new businesses.
Him for the first time in 1999. It was the blues festival and the arch, the piano stage at the arches, organized by Doc Lemming and Doc Cody. And we had a jam session at Doc Cody's house, I think it was, in his living room. There were two pianos and all them great pianists from all over the world. And I was very impressed. I was so shy among all those great talents. And Joe was there. And I remember I played the Boogie Woogie Stomp of Albert Ammons. And that's one number that I can play almost perfectly. And I could feel that it was very, very successful. And then I left the seat and I went back to listen to the others. And when I came just nearby Joe, he grabbed me by my arm and he said to me with his big voice, "Where did you learn to play boogie woogie like that?" I was so proud of that, because he was the like God in the paradise with all the saints. And that was something. And later on, he said to me someday, "Hey, you are Renaud Patigny from Brussels, Belgium." Brussels, Germany, he said, from Brussels, Germany. It's like if you would say you are Ricky Nye from Cincinnati, Minnesota, or Iowa, or Tennessee, or something. It was very funny.
But he would sometimes get names confused, like when he would call you Ronaldo.
Sabbath.
He was a great man, so human, on the human point. I mean, he was so friendly and so gentle, so sweet. invited me to a restaurant, and I invited him back, and so we went together to eat. And he loved to eat.
Oh, yes.
That's a topic in itself.
Yeah, the topic in itself.
I remember he was eating jelly with a spoon at home, yeah.
I know when we was in Paris, and we went out to dinner, he claimed he could speak French. We paid $50 for 4 bowls of fried rice. We didn't get and spring rolls. All he could order was spring rolls. And I kept asking to try to figure out something else that we could eat, you know. And Joe was like, "You ordered the spring roll." I said, "Joe, we need something other than spring rolls."
Man.
Then we went on the, it's a glass boat that went to dinner over in Paris and take you up the river past Notre Dame and all. And we went out to get in the cab. Joe was big, I was big, little Al was big. Russell was not big, but he wasn't
little.
No. And then we had a girl with us, Teresa Anderson, and she was kind of good size. Yeah, that Teresa, she was good size. We went out to the cab, but we came out the door, the guy was like, he was talking, you know. I said, "Listen, I know fat jokes in any language." Joe said, "Don't worry about it. It's an old joke. We just gonna ride." Then when we went into dinner, he was asked when they found out Joe could play. They asked him to come up and play, and asked me, and I sang a song with the lady that was there. So, and then so we had to tell him like, "Joe, you're not working now." I said, if you give him a sit in,
oh yeah,
you give him a sit in, and he gets in his if he get a hold to whatever, you know.
I call it being on Joe time.
Yeah.
That's being on Joe time. When because that happened at the Academy Awards when he got the Lifetime Achievement Award. Mm-hmm. And I was honored. Larry delegated that to me to give the speech. But beforehand, we're backstage, we're hanging out, and Joe mm-hmm. says, "You playing?" I says, no, I'm just," he said, "What?" He said, "Well, you got to play." He says, "You know Rollin' Pete. It's a boogie. It's a Pete Johnson, Big Joe Turner tune, mm-hmm. Rollin' Pete." I said, "Yeah." So it was his time to play. But, you know, he was not thinking about the schedule or the clock. So he plays about 3 blues. And then they're getting ready to get him off. He says, "Wait a minute." He said, "We got my guy, Ricky Dye's going to come up and play." You know, it's like, they're like, "We got to move on." And so I was like, "Okay." And it's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they're like, boom. And then he sat there and sang. And it was like all of a sudden, like, it was just so great. I guess what all I'm trying to say is that, yeah, when he got up on stage and got comfortable, he could just
play.
Just stay there all day.
Yeah, worry about the time, you know.
at the birthday party they had for him a couple years ago at Fat Fish when it was still operating. Man, I mean, he was on fire. And that was, from seeing him, I think that was like the last time that he really was able to really pour it on. And he sang until he couldn't even sing anymore. I mean, he just sang his voice out. It was like he was just there just to
enjoy,
totally pour it as much out as he could. And man, he just, I don't know that he ever got up.
I'm going to change my two or three different basses in here, and I'm going to mix them all in. And I'll let you guess who's who. I won't call them out to you. Here it is. It was three artists that done this: Mead Luck Lewis, Pete Johnson, and Abbott Ammons.
saw him about a week before I left to go to Europe on April 13th. And so, because what I was doing is when he was over in Avondale, he had, and they, Emma's daughter they were living with, wasn't it?
I don't know. Even Avondale. Now, when I was talking to him last, he was over in Wynn Terrace with his
right. Well, they moved
friend.
Out of there okay. into a spacious place that was right on Hutchins, right next to the WCIN. So plenty of room, and he was bedridden for almost the last year. You know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he'd be in and out of hospital, in and out of a nursing home, but really not getting around. So I'd really try to make a point of going over and visiting. As soon as I'd walk in, I'd turn on a piano, you know, and would sit and play, and he'd lay in bed and sing. And it was really, you know, you always wish that you, I wish I would have been able to go there every day, you know. It was beautiful moments. And he would improvise some great blues that I never heard him sing before, too. But, you know, he had good days and bad days, and it was just such a beautiful moment, you know, just me and him, and might go over and spend an hour, or he might not be feeling good. He might fall out after 15 minutes or something, you know. But I saw him about a week before I left, and that, like I said, that was April 13th, and then he passed on the 6th of May, I believe. I was still overseas.
You're gonna miss me. You're gonna miss me, babe. You're gonna miss me when I'm gone. When I think I'm doing right, everything I do is wrong. You're gonna miss me. You're gonna miss me.
I can say so much.
A couple of things. I was impressed by something else is that he was almost 80 years old when I met him first time, and was a young lady about 20 years old who was wanting to hang around with him. That's crazy. Such a young girl was charmed by that man. But he was has a lot of seduction, even 80 years old. That's crazy. Still a good-looking man. And
like you said, he was good age then.
And I have to say another important thing. I have an interview of Joe that I made years ago because I had a radio show for the Brussels University. And I remember one thing I asked him, what is the boogie-woogie pianist that you prefer, that you, for you is the number one? And he didn't hesitate 1 second. He said, Albert Ammons. That's the one. And then after Albert Ammons, number two, Freddie Slack. I was so surprised because Freddie Slack was one of the few white pianists playing boogie-woogie in the beginning of the boogie-woogie history. I would have think he would say something like Pete Johnson or someone like that. No, Freddie Slack. I was so surprised. Freddie Slack is, yeah, he was a great pianist. And he was very precise about his taste in music. He could say that one. And I said, and what do you think about Mid Lux? He said, well, too fast. He's playing. He was playing too fast. It's a good one, but too fast. And I remember he told me a story about a doctor in this village or the city where he was living when he was a kid. That's about 80 years ago. He told me that white guys of the KKK asked that doctor to come to the house because the wife of one of them, racist, was going to have a kid, but the kid couldn't come out. So the white guy said to the doctor, if you can't save my child, I kill you. Your head depends on the life of my baby. And the baby was born dead. So the best doctor in the world couldn't have saved that situation. It was impossible. The baby was dead inside of the mother. So he couldn't do nothing to that. Them white guys, they hang the doctor. And Joe saw that. He saw the black doctor hanging at the tree. Yeah. And so that's why I say Joe is one of the people who really lived with the blues in his skin, not only in the theory. You see, he knew what the blues is. Mm. And I remember the first time that he sung when we were playing at the jam session. He started to sing a blues, and that was wonderful. It was like something happened. What we heard, all them pianists playing was great music. But when he started to sing, it was magical. It was so wonderful. It was like the blues came into the room.
Hey, boy, where you going? I seen you going down that street the other night.
I don't know, boy. I've been where I'm going.
That's all right. I done see you just plumb out of sight.
Man, I sure look like on some that boogie-woogie tonight.
Oh, you mean some old fat boogie-woogie?
Yeah, that's just what I need.
That's just what I need, too, boy. If you want to hear some boogie, then I know the play. It's just a no piano and a knocked-out bass. The drummer made the guy they call 8-beat mash. You remember, Doc, and no beat me daddy slack. Man, it's better than chicken fried and bacon grease. Come along with me, boys, just down the road a piece, and that's good. I guess I better get on down that road. Your kicks. It's open every night about 12 to 6. If you want a boogie woogie, you get a field boy to shoot deep pizzas like no steam day. Come along with me, folks, and you there at least. Coming down the road, to be flat.
He didn't want to expose, to show piano technique like too many players are doing today. They just show notes and notes and notes. No, he was just playing and singing music, the real stuff.
I would say the one thing about his playing is that it got fine-tuned down to its total essence.
And he just had he had his own style. It was simple, but it was his style that made him the different or made him the greatest, because he didn't really struggle to do it.
I don't know that Cincinnati knew what kind of treasure they had here in Big Joe Duskin, but all the musicians and the people in the music community all knew how important he was. And beyond his playing and his singing abilities, what made him so important was his heart and the way that he made you his friend and the way that he was so loved and respected by pianists in the blues and boogie community all over the world.
You've been listening to Big Joe Duskin Remembered on the Blues. I'm Lee Hay on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati. Tomorrow afternoon, beginning at 4:30, it's the first annual Big Joe Duskin Memorial Birthday Party at Music Hall. For details, go to our website at wvxu.org.